Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Pycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! The delayed beginning of this program brought to you by Mother Nature and Crummy Infrastructure. This is The Horn. HeadOnRadioNetwork.com is where we live. That's where you go if you want to jump over into the chat room and participate in the real-time, real-world multimedia extravaganza that is the chat room conversation. It's easy. Just go there, pick yourself out a screen name, pick yourself out a password. And jump right into the free for all. Good evening, Carol in Australia. Good evening, Doctor Who. Good evening, 4 of 9. Good evening, Labor Man. Good evening, Mr. Gibson. Good evening, Mo Liberal. Good evening, Texas T. And good evening, Tim from L.A. All capably moderated by longtime inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who, being a third stage guild navigator, has folded space to become this evening Man Cave. Yes, yes, yes. I apologize for the late start, but it rained here. And I don't have enough of a command on that whole science-y thing to understand why, when it rains, an internet connection that is supposedly shielded from the elements all the way from the backbone to the central office to here. I mean, I don't think there's any naked wires hanging out there. But, yeah, okay, thank you, Tim. Gentle reminder that I should shut up from Tim from L.A., noting, what's rain, Bob? God. Hi, I'm Bob Kincaid, speaking of that, and this is, of course, Conversation Radio via the Head On Radio Network, a little effort that's been going on for about 10 years, in which you yourselves, over the years, have made sure continues. We hang on month to month. And I guess I should probably note this at the beginning of the conversation this evening. There's been a bit of a chat with the Brain Trust, and here's where we stand. You know, I've mentioned that we're trying desperately to get out front, build a 1 month cushion, what have you, to deal with exigencies like, you know, when equipment fails or crap like that, or a hard drive goes down, what have you. The consensus reached is that the $150 a night fundraising goal we try to make needs to be bumped by about $50. Now, that's not saying, you know, no. And once again, the reason for this is we'll continue to do this on a voluntary basis. Because there's people who can't, there's people who don't, there's people who won't. But we want this to continue to be available to people who ever want it, whenever they want it. You know, for instance, a lot of people don't think about it. But remember, after the program's over, we run a rerun stream that, for the most part, goes 24/7, unless of course the internet goes down. But it's all there, whenever you want it. You know, the same stream that brings you the program when it's live is also running the day's rerun, and on the weekend, it's a loop of all the programs of the week. Me, Dr. Bill, yeah. So, that's where we are. We're going to try to raise $200 a night and see if we can do that, just so we can, because, you know what? I'm trying to remember how many years we've been trying to raise $150 an evening, and frankly, that's a lot more. It didn't keep up with inflation. It certainly hasn't kept up with the price of telephony or internet. So there we are. We're going to try to raise $200 an evening. I hope not to get hate mail. Because it remains the single biggest bargain in national broadcasting, period. Yeah, it's been a couple of years. Right. And by the way, but you do understand about the internet. I just got a note from Darlene. Same thing happens here in high-cost Connecticut, Bob. Yeah, Connecticut. When it rains, the internet gets all messed up here, too. And apparently, I'm not the only one it happens to. No. Dr. Who says, tell me about it, Bob. Living in a rural area, I'm stuck with the old satellite internet, HughesNet. If we get hard rain here, the signal goes bye-bye. But see, that's the thing. I mean, this is supposed to be, you know, and it's not even crummy cable internet anymore. You know, they advertise really, really high speeds, but when everybody comes home from work in the afternoon, it just turns into a party line, and hey, hello, dial-up. That's why we gave up on the fabulously craptastic service from Shentel. Okay, so there we are. We'll try to raise $200 this evening, and we'll try to raise it tomorrow evening and every evening after that. Try to build up a little bit of a cushion. I was going to say, you know, let's just double up on May and try to build a 1 month cushion and go forward, but I was prevailed upon to do otherwise. Okay, yeah. Let's see. Okay, yeah, that puts it all in perspective. Thank you, Tim. Tim from LA noting, you know, $200 a month is still a lot less than Pacifica. They raise $4 million a year. And you know what? I'll put this program up against any one of theirs anytime. Not trying to sound all, you know, professional wrestling or, hey, come on down here, I'll break it. No. But really, I'm based on what I hear from listeners, this program is comparable to anything out there and better than a lot. I mean, remember, one nice thing about tuning into the horn is that you can have a lead pipe, rock solid, run to the bank guarantee that you will not tune in to this program and hear me arguing with or trying to persuade some wingnut that their wing nuttiness is wrong. Because, listen, you can never convince a wing nut that they're wrong. Because their thinking isn't thinking. Their thinking is belief, and it's driven not by rational intellectual process, but by ideology. And again, belief. Ideological believer in anything, whether it's crackers that turn into Jesus meat, any number of the conspiracy. George Bush protected America against the terrorists, but now that Kenyan Muslim usurper, he's a trying to invade Texas and put federal troops down here because he hates America. Try to dissuade any of it. It ain't going to happen. So, you know, you have my personal guarantee that you will not tune in and hear that on this program. So, there we go. It is, of course, Thorn in the Side Thursday on the horn. And, of course, we set aside Thorn in the Side Thursday. For those elements of right-wingery and freedom-protecting and liberty, sit, that let us know that all is not well. Now, remember, as we address the various topics we have this evening, and it's one of the reasons that I was really upset when it rained and the internet went down, is we have almost laboratory specimen level exemplars of thorn in the side thinking this evening, and I really, really, really didn't want to miss out on that. Start with something that I read in the New York Times. An article by Sarah Maslin Neer. And it is not something about which I'm going to know a damn bit. Or at least the initial topicality. The underlying problems, that I got. I don't know anything about getting nails done. I come from redneck culture. When you got when a feller's got dirty nails, he gets out the pointy part of his old-timer pocket knife, and he sits there and takes that pointy part, and he just kind of rakes it under the nails till all the grime and the filth comes out. And when that's done, well, you wash up before you wipe your knife off on a leaf or maybe on your trousers, and you fold your knife back up and you put it in your pocket. And then before dinner time, so lunchtime, breakfast, whatever, and various other times during the day, you wash your hands. Nails are largely, with the exception perhaps of high-priced, say, Wall Street hedge fund managers and stock hustlers and maybe the occasional tassel-loafered wearing trial lawyer, getting your nails done is largely something that is said to be a female luxury. Getting a mani and a pedi, yeah. And these nail salons have sprung up all over the country, and they are almost all routinely staffed by Koreans, Chinese, and the occasional immigrant, and they're all immigrants from Mexico and southward. And if you read this article by Sarah Maslin Neer in the New York Times, "The Price of Nice Nails," you will find that it is an ugly and brutal industry. Hey, look, it's America. What industry isn't ugly and brutal? I've been wondering about things like this for a long time, because, how to put this? This goes back into the 90s. Please understand, going into this discussion, there is not one iota, there is not one scintilla euris, there is not a micro itsy bitsy quantum particle of anti-immigrant bias in this or in me. But when a place as isolated as West Virginia suddenly springs up a whole bunch of Mexican restaurants, and understanding, we are a long way from Mexico here. Hell, we're a long way from Mexico, Missouri, which is really a place. I love to go there. It's not, you know, these little places, they were affordable. They were pretty inexpensive. The food was consistently good. If I ordered something and said caliente or picante, they didn't treat me like a gringo. And they brought it to me blistering hot, and I loved it. And all along, though, I wondered, you know, how does this happen? Because I suspected it wasn't someone in the community, some enterprising immigrant trying to work their way up to the American dream, who just happened to be in Charleston, West Virginia, who said, "Ma, let's open a Mexican restaurant and let them eat the cooking that you are so well beloved for within our familia." Mm-mm. Because they popped up all at once as a chain. And I will never forget because it was the first time that I had ever taken Agnes down south of where I grew up. Okay, back up. we all know I'm a grammar nerd and that I just notice things. And so it used to be that I would go to this one Mexican restaurant in Charleston and noticed right away that on their lunch specials, there was number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, and number F, and number 7 and number 8, etc. You know, 2 tacos, 1 burrito, beans, rice, whatever. But it was number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number F, number 7, etc. That F just leapt off the menu at me, and at first I thought, well, this is just a little typographical error. These are... You get the idea. But then, I remembered as though it were yesterday. It was a sunny, sunny, lovely day. And it was the first time that I had taken Agnes south to Alabama to meet the extended family. And we went into the local Mexican restaurant. They brought the menus, and I looked at it and went, son of a... Because there it was, the lunch specials. And it's about 600 miles from there to here. Number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number F, number 7. And understanding, of course, that I'm kind of simple in this way, I had a little epiphany. And I went, whoa, wait a minute. This is more than just a typo that wasn't worth fixing on a little Mexican restaurant in Charleston, West Virginia. This typo had, in fact, been replicated. And I began paying attention to it, you know, so we're on the way back and we stop at a Mexican restaurant in Bowling Green, Kentucky, and there it is, lunch specials, number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number F, number 7. And that's when I realized that this was a commercial enterprise. The menu was bought, the ingredients were part of a sort of kit. And then I got to thinking about where all the people who worked in these restaurants came from, and I went, whoa! What does that have to do with this fascinating nails article in the New York Times? Well, it's the same thing. I mean, for instance, lately, at least what I'm seeing in my world around here, and it's glaring enough that you go, huh? A string of ostensibly Japanese steakhouses featuring sushi has sprung up in unlikely places like Beckley and Summersville. But this time I don't have to wait for number 1, number 2, number 3, number 4, number 5, number F, number 7 to realize what's going on here. There's a food service that has put together an ingredient list. And there is some money back there who is bringing immigrant people in, because those are not fake accents, to work these restaurants. And of course, even though the restaurants themselves are billed as Japanese, these people are not Japanese. They're Chinese. And so it is with the nail industry, apparently. Only, if you read this article, this is really insidious. The Price of Nice Nails article in the New York Times is slugged. Manicurists are routinely underpaid and exploited and endure ethnic bias and other abuse, the New York Times has found. Well, of course they are. It's America, and they're immigrants. In the American form of capitalism, that's what immigrants are for. Immigrants exist to be abused for, you know, freedom and liberty. Sit, liberty. And this article details the nature and levels of the abuse. Because apparently a manicure in New York City, which is arguably the most expensive city in the United States, is like $10, where the national average is closer to $20. how's that work? Well, it works because the conditions in which the mostly young women work is a level of brutality that most in this country, especially most white people in this country, would think has long gone by. It's a level of brutality, for instance, that is hearkened back to by redneck Southerners when they say, well, yeah, once upon a time there was a need for unions when people wasn't paid fair and the job working conditions was real dangerous and stuff. We don't need unions no more because we got everything's took care of. I mean, we got OSHA, ain't we? Immigrants to this country are, of course, some of the most fragile people, legal or otherwise, in this country. For instance, a young woman going to work in one of the nail salons has to pay, she pays, they don't pay her, she pays $100 to get to learn the trade. And then, having paid $100, she gets to work for anywhere from 3 weeks to 3 months for free. For free. Before she's ever paid a cent. All this time, she has to keep herself alive somehow. Some nail salons have barracks above them, in which the women will periodically take little cat naps until somebody comes through the door wanting a manicure at 3 o'clock in the morning. Very, very seldom are any of these women paid minimum wage, even. So while we're out there, it's worth bearing in mind while we're out there considering the fight for 15. How about the fight for 5? Because apparently minimum wage and the jackbooted heel of the federal government or the New York State government has not yet found the necks of the abusers capitalistic entrepreneurs. You know, that's the problem with them. That's the problem with the French. You know, they don't have a word for entrepreneur. No, it hasn't found them yet. And, of course, meanwhile, these women are breathing deadly, dangerous, carcinogenic chemicals all day, every day. Yes, 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 sure, Mrs. Got Rocks. You worry about cancer, too. You sat there for 30 minutes getting your nails done. But what about the woman who spends 24 hours a day in that stuff? Because I'm pretty sure those fumes float upwards into the barracks, aren't you? Just looking at New York City alone, according to the article, the number of nail salons in New York City has tripled over the last 15 years. There are now more than 2,000 nail salons in New York City. Then this paragraph. But largely overlooked is the rampant exploitation of those who toil in the industry. The New York Times interviewed more than 150 nail salon workers and owners in 4 languages and found that a vast majority of workers are paid below minimum wage. Sometimes they're not even paid. Workers endure all manner of humiliation, including having their tips docked as punishment for minor transgressions, constant video monitoring by owners, even physical abuse. Employers are rarely punished for labor and other violations. You know, because the right wing, you know, the libertarians, the free market will take care of that eventually. I mean, Mrs. G. I Love Money will figure out that she's going to an abusive nail salon, so she'll just take her economic power and go to another abusive nail salon. America, what a country. Meanwhile, the women, in order to get here, have paid princely ransoms to people who are referred to in the Far East, in Asia, as snakeheads. These snakeheads are people who, for a fee, will get you in, and you'll keep paying the fee once you get here. Because they know where you are, and they will find your ass. And you keep paying, even once you've got a job here. You pay, and you pay, and you pay, and some people never even get free of the snakeheads. For people coming from south of the border, they pay coyotes. It's a different name for the same disgusting animal. A human animal who traffics in human flesh. But I was really, really just knocked down by this story this morning because it is such a perfect, and I do mean perfect, laboratory perfect, platonic ideal perfect example of the free market wonderland in which the likes of Paul Ryan and Scott Walker, and Ted Cruz, and God knows, libertarian ophthalmologist, Rand Paul and that thing on his head, think we should all live in. It's not just that young Korean and Chinese and Ecuadorian and Costa Rican and Salvadoran women are beneath their notice. It's that these repiglicans, these birthers, ninthers, deathers, tenthers, baggers, birchers, booger eaters, libertarians, repiglicans all think that this is the way it should be. And in point of fact, apparently according to this article in the New York Times, the nail industry, the manicure, pedicure industry in New York City and in other places, hell, there's one right across the river. Some poor immigrant soul from China or Korea or God knows where, and probably about a dozen of them, have been dumped unceremoniously in wet, almost level West by Cole, Virginia stand to eke out some sort of an existence. Steve writes in from New York. Ah, thank you, Jeremy. Jeremy says, I'm late, but loud and clear on TuneIn, Bob. Thank you, Jeremy. I do appreciate the fact that you take your job of advising me on our air status seriously, and I'm not being sarcastic. I'm really not. Under the subject line of nail salon, Steve writes in from New York City. I can tell you they're often one, two, three per block or more, and huge numbers are Asian women and Hispanic women. And that brings up another topic. There is a racial bias hierarchy in this system. Korean women are better than Chinese women. And Korean women and Chinese women are better than Hispanic women. Yeah, really. For instance, if you've got mostly Koreans in a nail studio, and a couple of Chinese women, the Chinese women will be forbidden from speaking. Not allowed to speak at all. If there are Korean women and a few Chinese women and a couple of Hispanic women, maybe the Chinese women and the Korean women will get to speak, but the Hispanic women will have to remain silent. You know, for a 12-hour shift. A lot of us have become sensitized to when we look at these little devices that none of us even had 15 years ago, but are now we're permanently joined to, and we think about the pathetic human beings in mainland China over there in the workers' paradise that is communism, that is fascism, that is authoritarianism, that is capitalism, baby. You know, working in factory city, you know, huge big city sized compounds of workers who spend 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, on their feet, forbidden to speak, working and to make our little smart devices, and under which the conditions are so unutterably god-awful that the corporation solved their suicide problem by extending nets out from the edge of the building further than the jumpers could leap. There's a remedy. But it turns out, you don't have to go to the communist workers' paradise of China to find such conditions. They're right here, in the land of the free and the home of the brave. Some women have to go, what little time they're given to eat lunch, they, because of their ethnicity, they have to go and eat in the basement because the people of the other ethnicity have decided that their food stinks. It was only last year, the Times reports, that the New York State Labor Department did its first sweep of nail salons in examining 29 salons. They found 116 wage violations. Of 100 workers the New York Times interviewed, only about 25 said they made the equivalent of the New York State minimum hourly wage. Of the 100 they interviewed, however, 97 disclosed that they endured wage withholdings such as never being paid overtime. There's a story, an account in the story of a Ms. Wren the patrons rarely spoke more than a few words to Ms. Wren, who, like most manicurists, wore a fake name chosen by a supervisor on a tag pinned to her chest. She was Sherry. She worked in silence, sluing off calluses from customers' feet or clipping dead skin from around their fingernail beds. At night, she returned to sleep jammed in a one-room bedroom apartment in Flushing with her cousin's father, and three strangers. Beds crowded the living room, each cordoned off by shower curtains hung from the ceiling. When lights flicked on in the kitchen, cockroaches skittered across the countertops. By God, that is some engaging prose. Almost all the workers interviewed by the Times, like Ms. Wren, had limited English. Many are in the country illegally. The combination leaves them vulnerable. Korean workers are paid twice as much as a Chinese woman. A Chinese woman is paid more than a Hispanic woman. And see, the sad, perhaps one of the saddest things about this is that you want to hope that most of the people, most of the women who go into these salons are decent human beings. Some of them even tip. But there's always a boss waiting there to make sure that, to notice that, I don't know, she left a nail clipping bounced on the floor. Well, that'll cost you your tip. I highly encourage reading this article, and it is it's a long one. Worth the effort. And just read it understanding, thinking about the fact that we're supposed to be past this. This is, after all,
the greatest country in the world on earth now, ever, today.
And again, to go back to what I said earlier, this isn't an abusive practice. This is an ideal. This is exactly the economic model that is beloved by the Heritage Foundation, by the Competitive Enterprise Institute, by the American Enterprise Institute, by the Cato Institute, by the Koch brothers, by the Teabaggers, by the John Birch Society. These nail salons aren't outliers. They are glimpses of a terrifying future, not just for poor Asian and Hispanic immigrants, but for white people too. This is how we come to understand that economic choices are moral choices. I mean, New York is a famously liberal city. And I can guarantee you that it's not only right-wing ladies who go to get their nails done. There's lots of good liberal women going to get... You're soaking in it. I wonder if there's an underpaid, abused nail worker somewhere in Manhattan named Madge. And so when you run across some wingnut, some purveyor of Ayn Randian chaotic economic anarchism, some Republican, in other words, and they want to talk about how we don't need a minimum wage, that the market will take care of the minimum wage and the cream will rise to the top and all of that happy horse shit. Point to the nail salon and ask them if that's their vision. And there it is. Steve just sent three photographs. Three on the same block. Just took these. Let's see. Unique shape. Facial waxing eyelash. And then... There's Sufu Nail and Spa. And I can't read the other one, but it's Nails and Spa. And here's the fun part. The owners, the capitalists in these things, have a union. Well, sure, we call it a trade association, but come on, it's a union for the owners. The Korean American Nail Association. And they've got enough money that if, say, because remember, money is now speech in America, just like corporations are people, my friend. And they've got enough money that if some uppity senator, maybe say Kirsten Gillibrand from New York, or Charles Schumer, although I kind of can't imagine him doing it, but maybe, how about Bernie? How about Sherrod Brown? If a senator gets all uppity, well, granted they're in the minority now, and no Republican senator is ever going to call a hearing on this in Washington, D.C. Not one, no, never, no how. But if by some weird, unlikely quirk of fate in this crumbling empire, some governmental elected official should show some interest in these rampant abuses, these giant screaming human rights nightmares, well, the Capitalist Owners Union, the Korean American Nail Association, will be right there to pass out some speech and make sure nothing ever comes of it. This is an immigrant nation. This is a colonial nation. I think to say it's an immigrant nation is a bit unfair. Because the people who were here first don't feel like they had immigrants. They feel like they had colonists. Gee, how many of the First Nation, the First Nations people, the First Peoples, who were dominant and prevalent on this continent prior to 1491, how many of them had a problem like the Korean nail salon problem? Hint, none. Just observing. Yeah, as Randy in PA notes, and thank you, Randy, for getting us started this evening. We are 25% of the way toward our $200 fundraising goal. Thank you. Thanks to Randy. Randy notes, libertarians say money is freedom. So if you've got no money, you've got no fill in the blank. And it ain't a hard blank to fill in. The Haymarket Massacre. We just passed the anniversary of it. The Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire. Matewan. The March on Blair Mountain. Oh God! What was the massacre in Colorado, and then there was of course Flint, Michigan. On and there was a huge Pullman strike toward the end of the 19th century. We went through these upheavals in an attempt to become a civilized country. But it was trumped by, they were apparently trumped somewhere along the way by capitalism. Do you suppose the entire nail industry would collapse if a manicure cost $30 instead of $10? Because I don't think it would. How can you have? Well, I'll tell you how. See, when you this all plays there's a role for every bit of wing nuttery in all of this. If you want to have a minimum wage, and if you want that minimum wage to be enforced, you have to have people capable of enforcing it. Those people work for the, again with the blanks, government. Okay? But birthers, deathers, ninthers, tenthers, baggers, birchers, booger eaters, Republicans, libertarians do not want that because, after all, they believe in small government. In other words, a government tiny enough to hearken back to drown in a bathtub, Grover Norquist. Because that way you can have all the laws about all the wages and all the working conditions you want. But if you have no one to enforce them, they're meaningless. Having spoken and mentioned a minute ago the indigenous peoples who inhabited this continent prior to 1492 and continue to inhabit it, I'm reminded of what happened when people took Andrew Jackson, who really should be removed from the $20 bill. They took Andrew Jackson all the way to the Supreme Court. Mm-hmm. And the Supreme Court ruled in favor of people who said that the Indian Removal Act was unconstitutional. And it was. What was the response of President Andrew Jackson? His response was to note, Chief Justice Marshall has made his ruling. Now let him enforce it. Because, of course, the Chief Justice had no enforcement powers. The whole, much of our governmental structure relies entirely upon the good faith of the people participating in it. And no, Andrew Jackson was not going to cooperate, and he proceeded with his genocide. This is much the same thing. They want a small government because they know a small government can't do anything to interfere with the inherent abuses that are baked into the DNA of capitalism. They want a small government, you know, big enough to keep writing the checks to the defense industry, mind you, big enough to keep passing tax breaks for the 0.1% in this country. But they don't want it to be big enough to speak up for public health or for worker well-being or for fair wages or safe workplaces. I remember back when Don Nealon, who used to be the head football coach at West Virginia University, Don Nealon, after he quit being a football coach, and God, so many of us were happy, he immediately took a position being a hackenflack for the West Virginia Coal Association, and shortly thereafter, in a newspaper article, said, "Well, gosh darn it, we gotta get rid of some of these job-killing regulations. I mean, we need to be able to mine coal like the Chinese do." That was a year, I think, in which something like 15,000 or 20,000. Chinese coal miners died because, of course, it was unregulated. Yeah. And way back in the beginnings of the idea of public health, the, I think, very first commissioner of public health, or very nearly the first, I can't remember his name, said, because back then New York City would be periodically just decimated by disease outbreaks, slumlords, you know, because money. And he said at the time, "You can have all of the public health that you are willing to pay for." In other words, it requires money in order to make it happen. And it will not happen, and no one was stupid enough to think it would happen back then, it will not happen if the industry self-regulates. You know, that's another one of those lovely little notions that's promulgated out of the Heritage Foundations and CEIs and AEIs and Cato Institutes. Industry self-regulation. Anybody want to check in with the Korean American Nail Association and see how that self-regulation's going? You know that little purple stamp you would see on a hunk of meat, maybe a roast that you'd buy at the grocery store, USDA approved. That stamp, once upon a time, could only be wielded by an actual paid government employee of the United States Department of Agriculture. Under concepts of self-regulation, however, the industry can just buy themselves a robot and every little hunk of beef that, and there hasn't been a federal meat inspector there in years. How many years had it been since the fertilizer factory in West Texas had been inspected? Was it 18? Before it blew up the little town there of West Texas, took out the high school, took out the junior high school, killed a bunch of people, sent a toxic cloud of particulated ammonium nitrate dust over the town that you could still smell 9 months later. We are, so to speak, living the dream of right-wing, anti-human, anti-labor, anti-family, anti-government extremism. See, they're smart, the right wing. They figured out all civil uprisings do not have to be accomplished with guns and bullets and bayonets and flags and armies marching in the field. Sometimes you can just buy yourself a government and start taking it apart. Note coming from Ron and Raleigh. I've started working in the housekeeping department at North Carolina State University. Most of the people that work in this department are Latinos, Africans, and Black Americans. These are the lowest paid workers on campus. As a temp, I make $9 an hour. Upper management has instituted a monitoring system. No one can be seen not moving. Strict adherence to breaks. 1/2 hour for lunch. The monitors turn you in if you don't toe the line. These people are terrified. I've been hired to move furniture out and in over 400 rooms so the floors can be stripped and waxed 5 coats. Last year there was a contracting crew of 15. This year there are 3 of us to do the same work. It took the contracting crew all summer to complete the job. We're expected to do the same work in the same amount of time. The staff haven't been given raises in years. The greatest country on earth now and forevermore. Yeah, and exactly. And the great mistake of reading an article like this one in the New York Times is to think, well, that's the nail industry. Not saying that any members of the Horn Family Commune congregation would do that, but rather the takeaway from an article like this is to read it, be horrified by the abuses, tell your friends and neighbors, make sure nobody goes into these nail salons, cripple them. Or go in and say, I'll be back when you're paying a living wage to your workers. Goodbye. Economic power flows in 2 directions, both directions. But the thing is, it's more than the nail salons. I mean, frankly, you've got a better chance of getting, of at least getting the minimum wage in a huge corporate chain than you do in one of these little mom-and-pop salons. Note from Diane coming in, the marvelously coherent Diane in Kansasstan. The chemicals used are largely unregulated and are known or suspected to cause cancer, allergies, respiratory illnesses, neurological, and reproductive harm. I won't even get my hair cut in a place that does nails. The smell makes me gag, as does even more the thought of exploitation of workers. See, we need a lot more marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas stands. Wonder when the last time a labor union picketed outside a nail salon was. Wonder when the last time was that a labor union tried to organize a nail salon. Yeah. I won't say never, but Tim from L.A. Under a note titled "What I Learned in My Asian American Studies About Nail Salons," I'm surprised an Asian immigrant spoke up. Most of the times, the workers are family members and are paying back their debt to the owner of the store for bringing them here to the U.S. When Bush signed the H-2B visa allowing people to work in the U.S., not only were the tech jobs stolen, but there's been an increase in nail salon jobs, too. They're underpaid, and the ICE and the DOL, Department of Labor, tend to look the other way because it's a family-run business. Many of the Asian workers are legal. Some may be undocumented, But in general, many Asians tend to follow immigration laws but regularly violate the 13th Amendment as well as labor laws themselves. In Los Angeles, civil rights groups are trying to get the employees to sue the employers for back wages and safer working conditions. But again, the Asians tend to keep to themselves so as not to disrupt the harmony called family. Yeah, a lot of this is cultural. The owners know culture and use it to their advantage. They may not whip them, but one goof up and back to poverty they go as they're deported to their country of origin. And don't forget the snakeheads who must be paid. Kelly with an email notes, Bob, East Coast Labor Solutions is a big part of what you're talking about. We have one in Fairleigh, West Virginia, run by a man named Ray Wiley. A friend of mine wanted to get me a job there. I checked it out and said, no. Yeah, sure. And that's the reason, thank you, Kelly, that's the reason that these abuses persist, because they develop their own infrastructure and it spreads. If this was a New York City problem, it could probably be solved in New York City. Maybe something will be done about it now that the New York Times has splashed it all over creation. That is the purpose of the Fourth Estate, after all. Or maybe not. Don't know. But it is much less likely to be solved nationally, because we don't want any overarching federal government. Because that's job killing. Only, you know, it's not. It's life saving. And as Diane in Kansas Stand notes, the problems have already emerged from the chemicals and the exposure. But rest assured, Jim Inhofe of Oklahoma would be there if the EPA was to suddenly get serious about human beings having to breathe cancer-causing, respiration-stopping poisons 8, 10, 12, 24 hours a day. If the EPA was to step in, Jim Inhofe would be there to scream bloody murder on behalf of the Korean-American Nail Salon Association. Yeah? Yeah. So, I've been filibobstering for an hour now. Let's take a little break. We've got the Green News Report coming up from Brett Friedman and Desi Doyen. If you would like to participate in the program, you know the numbers. We've got one call on hold right now on the Gizmo line. The Herald line is open, 304-574-8178. 304-574-8178. The other line, the Skype is also wide open. Bob Kincaid Horn, BobKincaidHorn. I trust you know how to reach me by email, bobkincaid@gmail.com. On Twitter, @BobKincaid. BobKincaid. There's only one K. CAID. And Bob Kincaid on Facebook. A little note, remind me, I got a little note about Facebook too, here in a moment. So let's do take a break. Light up the phones if you so desire. This is listener supported conversation radio. We've got $150 to go fundraising this evening. Hopefully, we'll reach that goal. I'm Bob Kincaid. Thanks, Ron.
wonderful time to be here. It's nice to be alive. Wonderful people everywhere. The way they comb their hair makes me want to say, it's a wonderful place. It's a wonderful place.
Thursday, May 7, 2015.
I think we might have made a little bit of history tonight.
A huge political clean sweep for Alberta, Canada, home of the dirty tar sands. New rules for oil trains, now with less transparency. Another disturbing milestone in global greenhouse gas emissions. Plus,
This is possible. That's the future we need to have.
Elon Musk revolutionizes the battery industry again.
All of those revolutions and more straight ahead. From bradblog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comments.
How do you change your own water use?
Turning off that faucet a little quicker, getting out of the shower a little faster. And not flushing the toilet every time.
Well, I guess they don't call him Governor Brown for nothing.
Oh.
This is your Green News Report. Okay, Desi Doyen, I'd like to take the opportunity to apologize for that snarky comment before the music there. What do you got for us today that isn't about Governor Brown and his flushing habits?
Well, first, a disturbing new milestone. Average global carbon dioxide levels have passed 400 parts per million in the atmosphere and stayed there for a whole month for the first time in recorded history. CO2 levels do fluctuate over the seasons, but this is the first time it stayed above the 400 benchmark for a whole month globally. And NOAA scientists say half of that rise in carbon emissions has occurred since 1980.
And the levels have not been this high since, 3 or 4 million years ago.
Yeah, it's kind of stunning.
Kind of disturbing. And the only way to stop it is to stop emissions of carbon dioxide.
That's right.
And if we don't, the atmosphere gets hotter and hotter and hotter.
You've got it.
I wish I had a solution.
Another day, another oil train explosion, this time in tiny Heimdall, North Dakota, where the entire town was evacuated Wednesday morning after an oil train carrying U.S. Bakken shale derailed and caught fire 2 miles outside of town. The fact that the blaze erupted despite new state rules requiring oil companies to siphon off volatile flammable gases before loading them into tank cars has led to some questions about whether those new state rules are sufficient.
Well, apparently not, because this stuff, this Bakken shale oil, is highly flammable. And we're just going to see more and more of this unless something changes. What will change?
Well, there's a little bit of change. This latest incident occurs less than a week after the Obama administration issued new, stronger safety standards for oil trains. The new rules require the industry to use newly designed, tougher tank cars, new braking systems, and reduced speed limits, among a lot of other provisions. However, the rules don't come into effect for another 5 years, and the railroad industry lobbied for and received a repeal of regulations requiring them to inform local governments when the trains are going through their towns.
And so the oil companies, in the meantime, I'm just guessing, they're probably contesting all of this.
Basically, they're saying, no, you should do more railroad inspections.
Somebody's getting railroaded here, but I don't think it's the oil companies.
In the home of the tar sands in Alberta, Canada, the Liberal New Democratic Party swept provincial elections on Wednesday as voters dumped the province's ruling Conservative Party after 44 years in power. In her acceptance speech, the leader of the New Democratic Party, Rachel Notley, called it a new day.
Friends, I believe that change has finally come to Alberta. New people, new ideas, and a fresh start for our great province.
Notley's NDP pledged to raise corporate taxes and reform oil royalties, while the losing Conservative Party had gambled the budget on increasing oil revenues amid a global oil price slump.
This is a huge shift. This is the home of the tar sands, where you've had this Conservative government who has, you know, trying to wring every dollar they can out of this dirty crap in the ground, frankly. And a real progressive party is now in power. Maybe we won't need that Keystone XL pipeline after all.
Finally, Tesla CEO Elon Musk has rolled out a new revolutionary home-based energy storage system. The Powerwall home battery is the size of a big screen TV. It stores energy from your rooftop solar panels, and it starts at just $3,500.
Just $3,500?
That's about the price of a new large screen TV.
Yeah, but I can watch a TV. What am I going to do with a battery?
Well, Musk says solar plus storage is the obvious solution to fight global warming.
We have this handy fusion reactor in the sky called the sun. Okay? You don't have to do anything. It just works. Shows up every day and produces ridiculous amounts of power.
And all of that power, if you can figure out how to harness it, is free. It also doesn't poison the groundwater, and it also doesn't explode when you transport it on trains. Thank you, Elon.
Tesla reports in less than a week, it has already received 38,000 orders.
For much more on all of those stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, please check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
Tiny Heimdall. Wasn't he the center for the old Canton Bulldogs? I'm sorry, something about that phrase grabbed me from Brad and Desi. Tiny Heimdall. I suppose now that the train's blown up in Heimdall, it's tinier still. But that's okay. Oh, hi, I'm Bob. This is The Horn. We are halfway through this Thorn in the Side Thursday. With the mention of the Alberta elections, I received a kind note from Kelly in Calgary. Kelly said, "It's been a while. I just wanted to drop you a line after our sea change election in Alberta. After 40-plus years of conservative government, the NDP, New Democratic Party, a social democratic party, took power here. Five parties ran, three of which are conservative, and yet the NDP took enough seats to form a decisive majority beyond any coalition of the other parties." Well, you mean the right-wingers get to go pound sand? Tar sands? Sorry. Why did this happen? The main reason is that the progressive conservative government, the PC, attempted to impose an austerity budget on us and used an election as a referendum to get a mandate. We told them no thank you. Canadians are so polite. There were other reasons, of course, but that was the main one. NDP is also promising to start cleaning up the environmental disasters that have occurred here, cancel the Northern Gateway Pipeline, the Trans-Canada Pipeline alternative to Keystone, which would have trod all over First Nation land rights, And I think some First Nations people were kind of instrumental in hollering, oh, not just no, but oh, hell no, and review plans for other pipelines. They, the NDP, have also promised to review petroleum subsidies and taxes. All good. All in all, a positive development, in my opinion. The NDP has governed in Canada before with varying degrees of success. I'm sure ASA in Vancouver will have a thought or two. But I see it as a step forward. Of course, we are talking about politicians, so it always is best to temper your enthusiasm. Let's just say that I'm cautiously optimistic. I've heard the U.S. media state that this is the first socialist party to govern in Alberta ever. That is incorrect. Before the PCs came into power, the Social Credit Party governed here for decades. Also Social Democrats. Wish us luck! Signed, Kelly in Calgary. Luck indeed. Luck indeed. If it can happen there, maybe there's hope for it happening here. And it happening here reminds me to tell you, Boss Man Wayne has created a new Facebook page because, among other things, I received a note a couple of days ago on Facebook from our pillar of participatory support, Faith. And Faith noted that there was as yet no Bernie Sanders Facebook page. Well, now there is. Boss Man Wayne created it, and it is Bernie Sanders, or West Virginians for Bernie Sanders 2016. Pretty please, look at it. Look it up on Facebook and go and like it. And once we've gotten sufficient numbers going there, and granted, it's West Virginia. You don't have to be a West Virginian to do this. We're just going to boost the numbers, and then we'll start promoting the page to people inside West Virginia. Okay? So your participation is much appreciated there. And it costs you nothing. Let's run over to the phones. I suspect it is John who has been ever so patient during the filibuster. Is that you, John?
Yeah, it's me. Hope the phone's good because I'm out in Idaho, Stan, so phone service maybe a little bit prickly around here. But,
so far, so good.
But your conversation kind of dovetails slightly what we were talking about on Tuesday. One of the downsides about, trying to drive up over minimum wages, and I saw this when I was living my less stellar life early days, messing around with economics is a two-sided coin, tongue and thing. If you jack up the wages, but you don't do anything about the costs, then all you do is just make capitalists richer. Example, when wages went up, I may be off on the date, say about 15-17% or so. You could get a part of the world I was in, a lot of the poor people would live in the little motels and week. About $99 a week. Well, the minimum wage went up, so too did the rents. The $99 to $115, thereabouts. And the argument, and this kind of dovetails into an article that I read in the San Francisco paper about comic book stores that were closing as a San Francisco passed a little minimum wage hike and forcing them out of business. If you don't do anything to try to take care of the backside, the rents are high, everything's going up.
Oh, sure. It's a complicated process, but there is nothing to indicate that, for instance, in the case of the nail salons, that paying these women actual minimum wage would be crippling to the business. The rents are high.
It doesn't.
But if you've got enough money to create and fund a Korean American salon and spa association or whatever, then you've got enough money to pay your workers a decent wage.
Oh, well, that's your opinion, Mr. Kincaid. You know the response automatically. I mean, it's, money's fungible and everything else. I mean, it's like what I do for a living. And people forget, you have hours of service. Now, on paper, I'm supposed to be able to work, you know, I'm allowed to work up to 70 hours a week. I get paid for a mile, blah, 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 and my life's not that bad, so don't think I'm complaining. But if you stand back and you look at it more objectively, you have an entire class of people that are working 30 hours a week overtime, but receiving no additional pay. And, you know, people look at it and go, oh, well, you know, you're getting paid for a mile, yeah, you're making lots of money, but yeah, I'm working equivalent to 2 freaking jobs. If you take the money that I make, especially on some bad weeks, I'd be just as well off working at McDonald's at current wages and working a double shift. So, you know, these people, they sat here and there was articles here recently about people that the money that, I think was it 45 years, the buying power of the worker has not gone up 45 years. I think the latest number that this came out with. 45 years, but productivity has continued to increase, double and triple, new machines, new cubes, all this stuff. But where did all the value go? It went into the hands of people in Wall Street. I've said this so many times, I know I'm maybe sound like I'm ranting here, but wages are not economic. It is not the freaking invisible hand. You get paid what your political power is. Are you union? You've got some way of leveraging that, you can make a decent living. But if you can't leverage, you know, you're done. You're going to make what they say is worth. And see it all the time. This industry I'm in right now has been inevitably calling and complaining about, there's a driver shortage. We need 200,000-300,000 more drivers. Well, you took college courses. You know well as I do that if you have a shortage of something, if you offered more money, what happens? You fill those slots. But they've been complaining about a driver shortage for 25 freaking years because they don't want to pay going rates. So go figure.
Yeah. Sure, it's a multifaceted problem, John, but any multifaceted problem has to be attacked starting somewhere.
Oh, yeah, I agree. They deserve that $15 an hour. Hell, they deserve $25.
Well, how about we start with busting some salon owners down to the ground for stealing their damn tips from them? How about we actually get serious about the idea of regulating the industry? Because I'm pretty sure none of these, I'm pretty sure none of these women have access to decent health care. What happens when they just start keeling over from, you know, cancer from all the damn carcinogenic fumes?
Well, they go get the free clinics.
Oh, the ones that don't exist?
Oh, yeah, those.
Right,
yeah.
Right, because I'm reminded that that Bishop Willard Romney said back in 2012 no one in America goes without health care.
Yeah, that's totally true, but then somebody is going to take the nose for it. And Mr. Romney, people, you know, if people forget and they kind of pass it over a lot, they know what it is, but they don't really know much about it. Actually, look at how that SOB made his money. He would go out and he would.
Oh, he made his money by abusing people the old-fashioned way, you know, the triangle shirtwaist factory way.
Yeah, he'd go out there and he would buy companies on leverage credit, buy these companies up, saddle them with a boatload of credit, get control of their pension funds, get control of their assets, get control of the land, the buildings, and all the other crap. And then he would do like that guy in that movie Pretty Woman, Richard Gere's character, you know, before he got, you know, awakened because of her niceness, yada, yada, blow, you know, whatever. But he was a scalper. He was a raider. He'd come in, he'd buy the company up, look at its assets, silo the crap of debt, get the debt passed on to the company, leave the pension program, and then sell pieces off for a profit. And you walk away, and you'd all be happy, as investors would be happy. That's one of the things about this country that really irritates me. Nowadays, it seems like most of the business in this world doesn't seem to be done doing anything. It's all, fake, manipulator. Let's fight over intellectual property rights. Let's not fight over actual people's wages. Let's worry about the decisions, lawsuits, and all the fake stuff. It makes me sad. It really does. Those people, those women, they come over here, they had a dream or an idea that maybe it kind of tells you something. If they're over here doing it as bad as it is, then they should stop thinking for a minute, what the hell did they leave? That they're still willing to sit here and do this.
Well, sure. But I'm not always willing to. I mean, it's not like, because remember, they have to pay $100 to learn how to do it, right? So they're not people who were, they're not people who were nail salon, who were manicurists in Guangzhou province who are coming over here with the same skill set. What China has an abundance of is just people, and they're in many instances, as we've seen from stories about people who go to work in the factory compounds, they're coming out of the countryside. They're people who were farmers, who were living a subsistence agrarian existence, much as was the case in the United States until the post-World War II economy. The constant war footing, constant consumption economy was put into place. For instance, if you go and you read Joe Bajant's book, Rainbow Pie, which has yet to be published in hardback form in the United States, damn every publisher here, you'll find him describing generations upon generations of Bajants who lived not wealthily, but comfortably and arguably happily in a subsistence fashion where you raise a couple of hogs a year, you got some chickens, you raise a garden, and there's very little cash, but there's survival. And that was deliberately taken apart in the second half of the 20th century in the United States, and what they're doing is the same thing in China. And so, yeah, I understand what you say about, if it was bad enough to make them leave there. As bad as it is, it still looks better than going back. I understand that. And I'm not in a position to say that they're wrong. But the entire system that has grown up around them, John, is abusive. And it's abusive for no other. It's abusive for no other reason than capitalism.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I do a lot of driving around California and stuff that, we're starting to move back into the season where you're going to see the massive number of people out there picking fruits and vegetables and stuff like that out of the California basin and everything. And that's damn hard work. And they're paid pittance for what they're doing. And yet they did a study not too damn long ago that said that they simply tacked an extra dime onto to each piece of fruit or whatever it was reflecting, that they would be able to have a living wage. But that dime is very seriously begrudged by the ownership class. They do not want to give it up. They don't want to give up that second house in hand. They don't want to give up that, that inherited wealth they're going to pass on to the pretty kids. There was a time in this country where, you could be rich, but beyond a certain point, it wasn't really worth the time. They had tax rates, the marginal tax rates were up to 90% and stuff. It didn't say you couldn't get rich, it just said that, there was a point when the bang wasn't worth the buck. and you could, but you had many incentives to take this profit forward back to your company. That money wasn't taxed. Put that money back in your company, you know, hire more workers, you expand your market share, all that stuff. But that stuff is all taken away. Now everything is sales. How much can I make the next 4 months? Stock share price. What's that price of my stock? What's my bonus going to be? That's where everything's at now. You know, your Korean Nail Association people, you know, hell, the guy is owning the damn thing, probably know not much more about nails than anything else. It's just an investment to them. You go after them, they'll close up shop and they'll open up the next, hair week.
Yeah, if you don't have a robust regulatory enforcement division.
Exactly.
So, well, you know, I'm just, you know, I am who I am, John. I'm after years of hearing pissant libertarians bellyache about big government. Well, you know what? I'm for big government because it's a big country and it's got big problems, and none of those are going to be solved by a small government. And it's one of those things that makes me want to tell Sherman to set the Wayback Machine for Bill Clinton and go back and just look at him and say, "What the fuck do you think you're saying?" When he stood there and shook his knuckle at America and said, "The era of big government is over." Well, I guess it was. And look who's paying the price. The people who can't buy a government, either big or small.
That's the truth of it. You've got people who will sit there and they have these box people that drive it in their head. They're punching. I hear it every freaking day. Every day I hear it. People out here, you know, there was a big conversation about that stupid shit down in Texas. You know, we got Chuck Norris running around talking about the bridge and, our liberties are being attacked. What? What is with these people? You know?
They're part of the idiocracy that is being conditioned slowly but surely to participate, if need be, in case our cold civil war ever gets hot. And for so long as it remains allegedly cold, they'll be useful to run to the voting booths and vote for the people who hate America. And understand, I've come to the point in my thinking that whenever I hear somebody say, "small government," I know immediately that we're talking about someone who hates America.
Yeah.
Or hates the United States.
Yeah, well, they want the CSA. They don't want the USA. That's what they want. They want to get better at States of America. They want the United States. They want to, you know, they want to raise their big old Robert E. Lee back out of Dan Brown and prop him up on Capitol Hill. And I think I've talked myself into a migraine now, which is some guy's here date. So I'll let you go and enjoy the conversation. Have a good night.
All right, you take care, John. It's good to talk to you. Stay safe.
Bye.
Bye now. Our buddy John out on the road in Idaho stand. It is 11 minutes before the hour on this Thorn in the Side Thursday. Both lines are open if you care to engage in the conversation. The numbers, of course. And 304-663-HORN. 304-663-4676. Okay. I mentioned, well, Jim Inhofe a little bit ago. It was actually kind of a coin toss to see which story was going to be the lead for this evening's Thorn in the Side Thursday. The Well, hold on. Let's not keep people on hold. But this other one, yeah, it only lost by a hair on a bee's butt. Hey, welcome to the program.
Hello.
Hello.
Hello. Is this Bob?
It is.
Oh, this is Carl from Western Massachusetts.
Hey, Carl, how are you?
How's it going? I talked to you, I think two or three times.
Yeah, we've cool. talked. Good to hear from you.
I'm an operating engineer. Right now, I work with a guy. He lives out in north of Boston, and the guy's got his own septic tank, and you know he's got his child with his child's wife living with him, two kids. So he's got two grandchildren in his house. His wife's on SSI, and he's one of these whack job libertarians. He sees jets in the sky, and he thinks they're spraying chemicals and everything else. And he's a union member, and he sucks the teeth. What I like to call sucking the pit, but he wants to designate where the cow is going to be feeding. His wife is bipolar, so she obviously collects SSI, and she's on Medicare or Medicaid probably, MassHealth. So she's getting about $1,200 a month plus probably $2,000 a month in medical benefits. And this guy is so my taxes, my taxes, my taxes. And it's just...
But never my country, my country, my country.
No. Oh, no. Government, 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 government. And it's... I dated him today. Because they're...
Carl? Carl? That sound means we've lost Carl. That was not a case of me pushing the wrong button. So hopefully Carl will get his signal back. Really, hopefully. Let me, as we move up to the end of the second hour, a gentle reminder that thus far our friend Randy has no company in our evening fundraising efforts. If you'd like to jump in alongside Randy, in our effort to raise $200 this evening, please feel free to do so via the PayPal interface at headonradionetwork.com or by the U.S. Postal Service, which is The Horn, 1038 North Eisenhower Drive, PMB 318, Beckley, B-E-C-K-L-E-Y, W-V, 25801. We have Jim Denver on the line. Hey, Jim.
Well, let me tell you, I've had some jobs like it's not as bad as the ones you're talking about, where you know what you have to pay to work.
Yeah.
But just like employers, I've noticed throughout my life, as I get older, I just become more aware of it. This is when I was working. Your friend and Malloy's friend. Sheldon Adelson's place.
Yeah, our buddy.
What?
I said, yeah, our buddy, Sheldon Adelson.
Yeah, your buddy. I know you're tight with him. But sometimes if you just stand around for a second because you just finished doing something, a manager, it's like they're trained to ask you, what are you doing? And I learned real quick to always have an answer about, okay, I'm going to go do the A, B, C, D, E, you know. And other jobs I've had, I've noticed people, managers, that's the thing. Like, I'll be waiting on, the last job I had, I was waiting, I chose to do it. I'd literally be waiting on a customer. She goes, Jim, what are you doing? Well, I just asked this lady what she wants, but if you want, I'll ask her again. In fact, I said that to her once or twice, but in fact, funny. Sometimes I probably say, well, I'm waiting for the second coming, but being an atheist, I don't think that's going to happen. But it's just that micromanagement, and then minutes, like, you know, like there's 60 seconds in a minute, 60 minutes in an hour, or 3,600 seconds in a second. If you're not busy, quote unquote, creating profit, and how you can, and if you're in some sort of sales job or something, you can't constantly be creating profit. You know what I mean? Because you once you finish a sale.
Well, but Jim, see, there's an underlying assumption. The reason all these lower level management types are standing around going, "What are you doing? What are you doing? Hey, what are you doing?" Well, I'll ask her what she wants twice if you want me to, like you described, is because the operating philosophy is that all workers are essentially lazy. And every minute that the worker is standing around not doing something is another minute that the billionaires are getting ripped off. It's not the billionaires ripping us off, it's us ripping the billionaires off. And you add that in with the Harvard MBA program, more bigger assholes, concept of worker productivity. Well, you know, if you're just standing there breathing in and breathing out, well, you're not being productive for the company. Right?
Oh, I know. Yeah, I know, but it's just so infuriating. I mean, you know, it's just...
That's why I would never survive in a situation like that, because the first time some little jackass looked at me and said, "What are you doing?" and said, "Well, I'm telling you to fuck off right now." What do you want me to do next? Leave? Okay, I can do that too.
Yeah, but I mean, it's like that, isn't it? I imagine it's like that on every level, because it's like, and you know, I've even gotten to the point where, you know, I get my 3,600 seconds in and out. You know, there's only so many things, even if it takes a second to do that thing. I can only do that 3,600 times. If it takes 10 seconds, I can do 360. You know, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. You know?
Right. I actually learned that all the way down to the ground. Nothing will teach it to you like, say, maybe being a little DJ, back timing songs into your next break. You figure out how much you can accomplish in what seems a very short period of time. For instance, in order to start the program on time here, I have to raise one fader, turn one knob, click one virtual button, and then click a second virtual button. All of that takes about 10 seconds. And it's actually quite a bit to accomplish. And nobody's hurrying, and I don't have a Walmart manager over my shoulder going, "What are you doing?" But you know, time has value and meaning. And even little bits of time have value and meaning. And the problem, Jim, is that the boys from Harvard's MBA program have figured that out. And they're down to worrying about seconds and fractions of seconds as part of management.
Yeah,
I remember once, I can't remember exactly what the topic was. Oh, I know. It was something related to finance and accounting and cost computation. And I remember the guy, it was a conversation had in the D.C. area years ago, and he said, "You have to understand, the really serious analysts are worrying about the 15th decimal place of a penny, because that's where the wealth is." And it blew my mind, but I've seen no evidence to suggest the contrary.
Right.
You know, working people worry about you know, what bills will get paid tomorrow. The billionaire class worries about what's going to happen a nanosecond from now, because they've got an accounting team who's told them that there are a few thousand dollars buried in that nanosecond. So that's why it is the way it is.
Yeah, I kind of figured that out or something like that. But I mean, I'm just talking about being a first person. And I think as long as I've worked for most jobs, it's kind of been like that. I'm trying to think back, but it's just, and the thing is, another thing I noticed this, was particularly the last two jobs, maybe just like 12, 13 years of my life, they don't want to hear it. They don't. All they want to do is be right. Even when they're wrong, they will never admit they made a mistake.
No, because that costs money too. That can cost lots of money.
No, even if it's like, but it's, you know, even when you got them, they will not, you know, try to go on to, just change the subject, go to a different point. You know, in fact, I remember one time what was her name? Oh, well. And she's like, I kind of had a disagreement with somebody, something. So, you know, like a meeting. And I said nothing. I was at the place in Vegas for a long time. And she was like, and I was explaining my argument to her. And the closest she could come was, I can see your point, I can almost see your point, but.
Well, see, they taught her that in a management seminar. Make them think you agree with them, and then show them how wrong they are.
That just made me realize I was more right, and it really, pissed me off. I just almost I give up. I just felt like to throw my arms up right there. I mean. I may not be the brightest bulb. I'm close there to the top, but I may not be the brightest bulb, but I'm not that stupid. You know, don't talk to me like I'm stupid, but, you know. And sometimes it's just better to play stupid, you know. Over the years, I've just come to realize that's how management is. That's the way the whole work environment, the whole capitalist system is. I mean, it doesn't have to, I don't think it has to be this way. It could be a lot better. But they seem to get joy out of getting, having people, paid to work like they do the nail ladies and stuff, which that should be a crime. Oh, and that's another thing I was going to touch on. What I've noticed they've done with different aspects of regulatory agencies. There, because I dealt when I was going through Social Security about a year and a half, two years ago, whatever it was. I started that process. I was going to Social Security, and this is in a small town in Louisiana, Stan. And there were only two people in there. It was like a third desk, but nobody was there. Fortunately, I'd gotten there early, so I didn't have to wait that long, but they understaff, and then what they do is they just don't rehire, they don't fire anybody, but just for attrition, there's less people to take care of more people, you know. So if you have like three windows, and then one person's no longer working there, you know, that's a third of the people, a third of their production taken down. You know, and I'm sure the people at Social Security, and then, you know, Social Security get written on. And then they ask, can you take a survey? And in fact, I called them up the other day for something. And I just gave them, yeah, everything was 555. I just gave them, you know, like, everything was good. Because the person answered my questions and everything was great. But I wasn't, and it's almost like you're trying to get that person answering that phone, answering your questions, has to be aware that there's a possibility that if, you know, which makes more pressure on them to do the job, which can, because the pressure can make them kind of mess up, but I can't experience that. But it's like, it seems like it's everywhere throughout, maybe it's capitalist system is the only thing I can come up with. not boy.
I absolutely do. I absolutely do.
Okay.
And the question, you know, the question then becomes, what's the solution? And I don't know that we're going to find solutions out here, but it's like when I was talking with John. If you want employers not to abuse employees, there is a way to do it.
Unions
are a great way. But at a bare minimum, if you have as a statement of public policy the idea that you want employers not to be able to abuse their workers, and in furtherance of that public policy you pass laws to try to ensure that, then you have to have a means of enforcing the laws, or else you're back at Andrew Jackson and now let Chief Justice Marshall enforce it. Because an unenforced law is no law at all.
Right, and it kind of relates to what started about what they're doing. It seems to me, and I, you know, they go over there 1,000 times. I don't want to go there, you know, 2,000. But when you go there, you know, like I said, there'd be 3 windows, but there'd only be 2 people in the windows. I don't know if that was that person's day off. And but I just remember that was kind of strange. And whatever, like I said, I got there early enough where there wasn't a line, and then just people being, you know, human beings being what they are, if there's a line, they automatically assume the people in the job, it's their fault. When it's not necessary, I would say it's not necessarily their fault. It's the system makes it their fault. Yeah. So. Well, I mean, that's what I've noticed, you know, and I'm talking to you and going back to all the jobs I had. I mean, even when I was for a while, I was so close. And even then, the guy himself was a commission. It was commission versus draw. So you had a draw on that. But even if you sold $600 seat a day, this is a long time ago, your commission was like 6%, which is $36. But even then, it takes about an hour to get a person. And, you know, would you like a tie with that? You know, like you say, how about a nice, yeah, you need a Oxford collar shirt. That would be, you know, of course it has to be white, blah, blah, blah. All that takes time. So you're talking about 1/8 of your day, basically. On that one sale, if you could do that every hour, okay, it's 8 times 36, 240, 288. That wouldn't be bad money, but it's not like that. And it's not everybody coming and buying suits all the time. Buying $600 suits is probably cheap now, but back then it was a fair amount of money.
Are you out there beating the streets of Denver? Are you finding anything?
I got some leads. I'm looking for, I've got the disability. So I'm looking for something part time. Plus I got to find more. I'm more in Aurora than I am Denver. I got to get more into Denver. So I've been doing that. Kind of both. So, in fact, I'm about to, I think they're going to give me some sort of, check out the grocery store scene or something like that. It's so much fun working in a grocery store. Or something else, because I have to keep my income under a certain level, or then that affects the disability.
Well, at least you haven't quite gotten to the steadily depressing, low-down, mind-messing working at the car wash blues.
The what?
Never mind. Old joke.
Steadily
depressing, low-down, mind-messing, working at the car wash blues. The Jim Croce song, Jim.
Oh, yeah, I do remember that, yeah. Yeah. No, but, yeah. It's just the whole kind of, you know, when I walked in, and I turned on your show, and it's just like right away I identified with it, because you go, I go work in a Chinese mail place and stuff. I've been close to jobs like that. It doesn't surprise me that they're still around. And like you said, that's the whole idea of capitalism. The 1% of them.
Well, look, we throw around the word sweatshop, and one of the problems with that word, Jim, is that it creates a certain idea, a certain mental image. And nobody is going to generally think sweatshop when they walk into a nail joint. I mean, there's leather-padded chairs and iPads and music and chandeliers and the women are often picked based upon their appearance. So they're lovely. And so you don't walk in and go, well, goddamn, look here, a sweatshop. But it is one. It's an ugly one. And there's no getting around it.
Was it. After I'd done my look around today, before I came in, I picked up some Chinese food at this little place down the street. And we just started talking about it. I started thinking about, that place. It's very small. It's a very small little, I got some egg drop soup and some fried rice and sort of chicken and vegetable stuff. Yeah. Under $10, And, But I was thinking about, I wonder if those people are making them there. And then I think I should have tipped more. But now that'll happen next time, next week, if I go out there, if I stop by there. That's the whole capitalist system in a nutshell, man. I mean, every level of the way, they're trying. Because I wondered if I would have gotten into up mid-level management if I would have tried to change anything. I know exactly what would happen as soon as you start trying to change your goal. You are not in that system, right?
Yeah. And look, on the one hand, you have people who talk about human worth. And we're talking about human worth qua human beings. But that gets translated into something like like the Harvard Business School, and the next thing you know, you've got some bean counter from hell going, human worth. Well, okay, the chemicals alone are probably worth about 67 cents. The caloric intake and output, and suddenly the boys on Wall Street and the hedge fund managers and the corporate kings of the universe are going, shit, that's a lot of money. All we got to do is take it from them and give it to us. Bingo. Yeah. Free market capitalism.
Yeah. But, I mean, it's just like, if you really start speaking truth to power, you make Bernie Sanders look like because Bernie Sanders, does a great job of talking about what's wrong, but he does it in a complimentary. He does it in such a great way that it doesn't seem too threatening. Because even the word socialist, even though you mentioned socialism, most people may not even know. And it's like, my next argument would be, you like the police department, you like the fire department, we know it's a socialist organization.
I wouldn't use the police department as an example of socialism because that reflects poorly on socialism right now.
I know, but an idea, maybe areas, with Barney Fife and Sheriff Andy in the good old days of the police department. I could use the military too, but what has the U.S. military done? Besides invading us by foreign nations for the profit of others and not for anybody but the 1%. I mean, since I've been alive, as far as when I think about it, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq.
No, see, you were born within the post World War II transition to the consumer economy. That's a very special kind of America. It's a country that's on a permanent war footing, because the whole reason for coming up with the post World War II consumer economy was to have the same levels of employment that we had during World War II in order to keep the economy from crashing, which often happens to the victors in wars. Because the people who were fighting the war, the ones who didn't get killed, come home and they had trouble finding a job.
Yeah. Well, and then also, and they wanted to try, I think the second FDR died, they started making plans to just...
Well, it was before he died, because FDR was sick, and there's a reason that Henry Wallace got bumped off the ticket in favor of Harry Truman.
Yeah.
Because Henry Wallace was a rabid anti-fascist and had socialist leanings. And had Henry Wallace achieved the presidency upon the demise of FDR, it would have been a very, very different story.
Yeah, boy, things would have been different, yeah. It would have been eight years of that. But see, that's the other thing, because, like, then you also have, right after, okay, they go through the Great Depression, and I think most people who went through it were pretty aware of the fact that it basically the Republican freewheeling capitalism that brought the country into it. But it seems after 20, 30 years, people forget, and they just think, well, yeah, that boom and bust cycle of capitalism really isn't that bad. And of course, I'm going to end up on top because Jesus likes me more than other people. And they couldn't wait to get back into it, and they have it, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, well, I'm with somebody else go on. I think.
All right, Jim, it's good to hear from you. And I'm glad the confluence of your trip into the Chinese restaurant along with the lead story this evening engendered a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Good egg drop soup.
All right. Try the hot sour. I'm a hot sour soup guy. I'll talk to you. All right. Talk to you later, Jim.
All right.
Formerly of Louisiana Stan, that's Jim Denver. It is 18 minutes past the hour, and assuming that the phone doesn't ring again, I'm going to get to the story that lost out to the nail salon story by one hair on a bee's butt. You knew, didn't you, that it wouldn't take long for Senator Snowball to respond to the news that we have surpassed 400 parts per million on a global basis of CO2 in the atmosphere, right? Yeah. All right, I'm going to go ahead and finish this story, and then we'll go to the phones. Well, it didn't take long. It was yesterday when Senator Jim Snowball Inhofe, a man with more dollars than cents, took to the floor of the United States Senate to, we have oil spills and bomb train explosions. Well, there was a big stupid spill in the Senate of the United States on Wednesday, and it poured out of the gob of Senator Jim Inhofe. Now, just as a general reminder, Senator Snowball actually runs the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. That means any bill dealing with the environment or human beings' ability to live in it, which I think is really the larger inquiry here, has to get past Senator Inhofe. Man, he's enough to make you pray for the rapture so that Jesus would just snatch him up through the clouds and we could actually do something about our problems. Because, of course, Senator Inhofe is on the take. He is, you'll note that he's about to quote something that sounds kind of science-y sounding. Well, he didn't just get up and Google that this morning. The American Petroleum Institute and the Koch brothers and the usual suspects have phalanges of lawyers and paid scientists who looked out the window every morning and see that the sky is blue and immediately issue a paper saying that it's pink with purple polka dots. And then they pass it along to Senator Snowball. Right. So, first hockey puck warning of the evening. Yep. Strap in. Here we go. The stupid is strong with this one.
Counter to the doomsday predictions, a climate alarm is increasing. Observations suggest a much reduced and practically harmless climate response to increased amounts of atmospheric carbon dioxide.
You know why there's such an echo in the room? Because nobody's there. Because if anybody was there, about halfway through, I don't know, somebody would have to yell, "You're an idiot!" Because he is. I'm surprised this guy ties... You know what? I bet he doesn't tie his own shoelaces. And by the way, Senator Inhofe, where's your American flag lapel pin, mister? Why do you hate America? Well, actually, he does hate America. You don't have a flag pin. Must have left it on his pajamas. No, so anybody who doesn't want to see the planet roasted beyond the ability of human beings to live upon it, and remember, we haven't had this much carbon dioxide in the atmosphere since a few million years back, when there weren't any humans, right? Yeah.
Now, counter to the doomsday predictions, a climate alarm is increasing. Observations suggest a much reduced and practically harmless climate response to increased amounts of atmospheric carbon dioxide. Also missing from the climate alarmist doomsday scenario and well-scripted talking points are the benefits from increased carbon that has led to greening of the planet and contributed to increasing agricultural productivity. People don't realize you can't grow things without CO2.
Absolutely not. Green things, plant things, vegetative things, they breathe in CO2 and breathe out oxygen just like we breathe out oxygen, either breathe in oxygen and breathe out CO2. You can't grow things without CO2, which raises the obvious question that given the fact that Mars has a CO2 atmosphere, why isn't it the greenest planet in the solar system? Yeah, well, let's not complicate matters. Randy and PA pointing out something's really wrong with that clip of the senator. He sounds like a faint version of Skeletor. There's nothing wrong with the clip, Randy. That is what Jim Inhofe sounds like. That's what Senator Snowball sounds like. Mark in Florida likes my attention to detail, noting that Senator Inhofe isn't wearing his flag pin. Sylvia wants to know, am I wrong? I think you meant phalanxes and not phalanges. I thought phalanges was the plural of phalanxes. Maybe I'm wrong. I think they stem from a common Greek root, do they not? The marvelously coherent Diane in Kansas stand, echoing the sentiment of Randy and PA. He sounds like a Borg. Only because he is one, Diane. So let's go back here because the alarmists don't understand that plants can't grow without CO2. No, he's speaking in an empty chamber, and so consequently, I don't know who's in charge of technology in the Senate, but I've seen this for years and years and years. They've got this really stupid microphone that they wear. I mean, I'm guessing that the people in charge of the audio in the Senate were right there at the invention of microphones, because this thing's a damn dinosaur. We've got audio technicians, for instance, our buddy Liberal in South Carolina, who might tell me, but it's about as long as a cigarette and about as big around, and it clips onto your lapel, and it is crap. Because not only does it pick up the senator, it picks up the room, which is why, and which means there's probably no gate, no limiter, no compression on the microphone either. Because the Senate being the most august and exclusive country club in the world, can't be expected to have adequate technology. Hell, we're lucky the Republicans haven't installed soapboxes and stumps to stand on. But it was that way under the Democrats, too. So, I mean, who's in charge? I personally think we should mic every senator with little, we should have 100 wireless microphone, rigs and a distro for them. And every senator should be required to wear a wireless mic, and it should be required to be turned on at all times. Then, by God, we would know how the business of the people, we the people, is done. Anyway, back to Senator Snowball.
From increased carbon that has led to greening of the planet and contributed to increasing agricultural productivity, people don't realize you can't grow things without CO2. I
mean, we're going to have more vegetables because of all this CO2. Mm-hmm. And we're going to water them with the acid from the ocean, because it's not going to be much good as water anymore once it gets good and CO2 acidified. Nah, you can't water plants with salt water, silly! We'll water the plants with, I don't know, fracking wastewater. Oh, wait. That's already happening.
CO2 is a fertilizer. It's something you can't do without. So no one ever talks about the benefits that people are inducing that as a fertilizer on a daily basis. And despite the admitted gaps to the scientific understanding of climate change and a track record of climate modeling failures, President Obama and his environmental allies are holding fast to their bedrock beliefs. They are intent on selling the present so-called climate action plan to the American people that is less about protecting the environment and more about expanding the role of government.
Yeah, okay. All those modeling failures, the hockey stick, it turns out, after God only knows how many peer reviews, is real. But not in Senator Snowball's world. Well, internet latency must be hell tonight, because Devin just asked, why does he sound like the Borg? Because he is one. And backtrack a little bit for a discussion of acoustics and the crummy, crappy audio used by the Senate. Now, what? It's not just Jim Inhofe. He just happens to be the public face of stupid. But it's not stupid, it's economics. He is paid to be that stupid. He is paid to be that ignorant. He is paid and well paid to be that obfuscatory. And he doesn't care who he kills. Climate change, it's probably just killing brown people anyway, right, Senator Snowball? Well, no, not really, because there's a good bit of climate change happening in Oklahoma, Stan, too. They get right thirsty there from time to time. Don't get enough rain when the increased numbers of tornadoes blow through. Oops! How do you keep your equanimity if you're a rational person in the Senate? How do you not just go across the table? When there's a stupid spill out the mouth of Senator Snowball. I don't know. Because I don't think the average functioning human brain can tolerate it. When I was listening to this clip earlier today, I was reminded, as I often am, of something written by Mark Twain. It's called How I Edited an Agricultural Paper. The point being that the author has no knowledge whatsoever of agriculture at all. I did not take temporary editorship of an agricultural paper without misgivings. Neither would a landsman take command of a ship without misgivings. But I was in circumstances that made the salary an object. See, it's the same thing. Jim Inhofe likes the money that comes from the American Petroleum Institute, and there's nobody out there on the climate change side that's pumping that kind of dough into the personal economic ecosystem of Jim Inhofe. That's where we're failing. I mean, I can expand on that. There's nobody on our side who is funding the actual dissemination of real information about climate change on a media or a political basis. Shit. You think the Sierra Club has the money to buy senators like the American Petroleum Institute does? I mean, granted, Sierra just got $60 more million from Michael Bloomberg. But that's a drop in the damn bucket to a trillion-dollar affair like the hydrocarbon industry. The American Petroleum Institute can send out an assessment to Exxon and Shell and BP, and they all just go, well, fuck yes, I'll write the check. And the next thing you know, Jim Inhofe's happy again. The problem is, our good friends at Earth Justice, and they are mighty good people, have a slogan. Because the Earth needs a good lawyer. Earth Justice is a legal outfit. The Earth does need a good lawyer. But in a political system in which the Supreme Court has patently ruled that money is speech, the Earth needs a good palm greaser, too. And we ain't got them. You know, we could enter into a bidding war for Jim Inhofe. And if somebody would pony up the bucks, we could have him. And he would be a champion of the struggle against carbon pollution and global warming overnight. Because Jim Inhofe is for sale. Because Jim Inhofe is in circumstances, as Mark Twain put it, that make salary an object. The regular editor of the paper was going off for a holiday, and I accepted the terms he offered and took his place. The sensation of being at work again was luxurious, and I wrought all the week with unflagging pleasure. We went to press, and I waited a day with some solicitude to see whether my effort was going to attract any notice. As I left the office toward sundown, a group of men and boys at the foot of the stairs dispersed with one impulse and gave me passageway, and I heard one or two of them say, "That's him!" I was naturally impressed by this incident. The next morning, I found, and you know, the same thing happens with Jim Inhofe. People point and they go, "Oh my God, that's Senator Snowball!" And I'm sure Jim Inhofe just loves the attention. The next morning, I found a similar group at the foot of the stairs and scattering couples and individuals standing here and there in the street and over the way watching me with interest. The group separated and fell back as I approached, and I heard a man say, "Look at his eye." I pretended not to observe the notice I was attracting, but secretly, I was pleased with it and was purposing to write an account of it to my aunt. I went up the short flight of stairs and heard cheery voices and a ringing laugh as I drew near the door, which I opened and caught a glimpse of two young rural-looking men whose faces blanched and lengthened when they saw me, and then they both plunged through the window with a great crash. I was surprised. See, I don't know how you don't... If you're a member of the United States Senate, I don't know how you don't just throw your hands into despair when Senator Snowball starts speaking, and run tearing at your clothing and your hair, running out of the chamber. Because that's what it does to me. In about half an hour, an old gentleman with a flowing beard and a fine but rather austere face entered and sat down at my invitation. He seemed to have something on his mind. He took off his hat and set it on the floor and got out of it a red silk handkerchief and a copy of our paper. He put the paper on his lap, and while he polished his spectacles with his handkerchief, he said, "Are you the new editor?" I said I was. "Have you ever edited an agricultural paper before?" See, I have this vision of some member of the United States Senate in the role of the old gentleman with the hat and the red silk handkerchief. Some intelligent one. Some member of the Senate who actually knows that climate change is real and that we're on the way to effing ourselves right out of a planet to live on. "No," I said, "this is my first attempt." "Very likely. Have you had any experience in agriculture practically?" "No, I believe I have not." "Have you had any experience in science, climate science practically?" "No, I've told you before," said Senator Inhofe. "I'm not a scientist." "Some instinct told me so," the old gentleman said, putting on his spectacles and looking over them at me with asperity while he folded his paper into a convenient shape. "I wish to read to you what must have made me have that instinct. It was this editorial. Listen and see if it was you that wrote it. Turnips should never be pulled. It injures them. It is much better to send a boy up and let him shake the tree." Now, what do you think of that? For I really suppose you wrote it. Think of it. Why, I think it's good. I think it is sense. I have no doubt that every year millions and millions of bushels of turnips are spoiled in this township alone by being pulled in half-ripe condition when, if they had set a boy up to shake the tree, shake your grandmother! Turnips don't grow on trees! At which point, and just imagine all of this as a climate discussion, Senator Inhofe says, "The science is not settled on where turnips grow." We are afflicted by a plague of jackasses in this country. Yeah, that's really kind of hard on the jackasses, isn't it? There is a cost to be paid for the willful stupidity of Senator Snowball and his pals. And it is a cost that they themselves will never pay. Not a nickel. Not a penny. The cost will be paid as most horrendous political and social mistakes have a way of happening. The costs will be paid by those least able to afford them. And they're already being paid. And at the end, that little gem, President Obama and his environmental allies are holding fast to their bedrock beliefs. These aren't beliefs, you goddamn fool. They're science. Science ain't religion. Science doesn't give a rat's rear end whether you believe in it. The law of gravity does not get up every morning worrying about whether Jim goddamn Snowball Inhofe believes in it. They are intent on selling the president's so-called climate action plan. No, dumbass, it's not so-called. It's called that. It is their climate action plan. That's the title of it. But some pitiful, punk-ass, ignorant little Republican aide has written so-called into that speech that you were boarding into the record. So that's what you read. It's less about protecting the environment and more about expanding the role of government. Well, at this point in time, I think after a generation of Republicans and libertarians and Ayn Randian anarcho-capitalists screeching about big government, it's about time the role of government did get expanded. Maybe so little Chinese girls don't wind up working for a dollar a day in a sweatshop. Or maybe, so his grandchildren can have a planet to live on that will support human life. You know, they used to mine coal in Oklahoma a little bit. Maybe they still do. I don't know. Ask an underground coal miner about the life-sustaining nature of CO2. He'll be happy to tell you about the number of people who died in the hole trying to breathe it. But as long as Jim Inhofe has air to breathe, well, everything is just dandy. Right? Yeah. I wish I had an answer. I wish I could say, well, if you'll only do this, we'll be okay. But I don't. And sadly, I don't think anybody else does either, unless it has to do with voting him out of office. But that is a job left to the people of Oklahoma Stan. And they're not going to do it. Because they feel, they believe, and there's that right there, living proof that that is, in fact, the most dangerous word in the entire English language. Not kill, not hate, not rape, not murder, not arson. Believe! Because the people who return Jim Inhofe to office term after term after term, they believe just like he believes. I've never heard a Borg joke before, Robert in Australia. How do you stop the Borg? Let them assimilate a copy of Windows 8. That's it. We'll make Jim Inhofe work. Never mind. So we are 16 minutes away from the end of the program. If you want to engage in conversation for these last few minutes, you are welcome to 304-663-HORN, 304-663-4676, or 304-574-8178. Either way is fine by me. Bob Kincaid Horn, Skype to Skype. And yes, as you heard in the Green News Report, another bomb train has exploded. It exploded yesterday in tiny Heimdall, North Dakota. 40 residents were evacuated. 10 cars came bounding off the rails and blew up. But again, we need not worry because What would be the good analogous equivalent to not stopping the bomb trains altogether Yeah, we're going to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic. Because this stuff cannot be shipped safely. As you noted from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen, oh, by God, the oil industry says that the railroads need to be investigated. And the railroads, frankly, and the people who work on them, don't want to transport this shit, but railroads are common carriers. And they can't refuse. I don't think. But it can't be safely transported. It can't be done. And one of these days, we're going to have another Loch McGontic, or it's going to be even bigger. One of these days, one of these things is going to blow up going through a seriously populated area. And there will be the oil industry pointing a finger at the railroads. And the Obama administration, what happens if somebody dies in one of these bomb train explosions sometime between now and the 5 years from now, in which the cars have to be more safe? Do we just go back and cue it up again and play Bill Clinton wagging his knuckle at America, saying the era of big government is over? See, that's another place where some big government might come in handy. But we can't have that because the goddamn libertarians might cry and stomp their feet and hold their breath. And we can't have that. Back to the phones. Maybe we've got Carl again. Is that you, Carl? Lost Carl again. Wow. That's the breaks, I guess. So, nothing to see here. These are not the bomb trains you were looking for. Bomb trains are good for America. Freedom! Right? Sure. What else? Speaking of hating science, like Jim Inhofe does, let's take a quick trip down to Talabama. Stan. Or not. Okay, it looks like Carl's making another yeoman attempt to reach the program. Are you there, Carl?
Yes.
Hallelujah, glory, we got you this time.
Yes, Siri took over the last time I was talking. So I had to disable her.
Ah, I understand.
iPhone stuff. I don't use Siri, and something happened on my phone case. I don't know.
No worries.
Anyways,
when last we talked, you were telling us about your libertarian union brother.
Yes. Now he's a union. He's a union guy, but and his wife is on SSBI or whatever you want to call it. So she has mass health. And this guy, every time you talk to him, he just starts screaming, "Well, my taxes," and the way I put it is, if you're sucking on the tit, you cannot tell me or tell the cow where the cow is going to graze. You know, because obviously probably the $800 he makes a week in taxes or in wages, and maybe he pays $300 or $400 a week in taxes, is not going in taxes. He's getting, him and his wife is getting more out of the taxes than he's actually paying in. But he screams and screams constantly about how much the government screws him. You know, his taxes are going up, they have to do this, blah, blah, blah. It's unbelievable when you listen to these people. They don't stop. and you try talking sense into them, and they won't listen. The day after.
Well, I mean, if he's a libertarian, why is he in the union?
I don't know. Well, he's not a libertarian. He doesn't claim he's non-political. He tells me.
Yeah, he's a libertarian.
He's an independent.
Libertarian, won't admit it.
Yes. But his substance comes from the government. And where he gets this, because we do bridge jobs and road jobs, where does the money come from? Taxes.
Well, sure. Those are, that's the kind of work that, you know, those are public works. I mean, is that Davis Bacon work?
Yeah, where is the money that's paying our company coming from? It's not coming from private sector. It's coming from taxes. And I try to explain this little a-hole. And he's 62 years old. And he's a laborer, basically. He's a good guy. He works very hard. He's smart at what he does. But he's small. And it's like, okay, the teeth are bad, you got gout, and your wife's bipolar, and you're bitching about the government. And hopefully if they don't take away your Social Security, hopefully your pension's still going to be there. No, because it might not be there. And I try to explain to this guy, oh, blah, 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 it's government, all the time, government. But he doesn't understand that the government is the people, and the big corporations want to take over the government.
So that is the success of a right-wing talking point or a right-wing attitude that has been manifested for 30 years now, that there is something that's called the government, and then there's something out here that's called us.
Yes. And us is supposed to be the government, and government is supposed to be us.
We the people, man, you know?
Yes. And he doesn't understand that. People just don't understand that. They look at the right wing, what did Theodore Roosevelt call them? Can you help me? The corporate, not corporate, the royalists.
Yeah, all the economic royalists, yes.
Economic royalists. They have the microphone. They control it. They have so many ways of putting it to people like him, people who think a little bit differently than him, you know, people who dip up at the stars and see God or whatever. They have they have so many different ways of controlling how people think or speak. You know, they have so many niches and so many ways to, you know, they spend their money. And they have so much control on how people think. Not think, but their information. And this guy here is gonna, when he gets 65 years old and he thinks, or 67 and thinks he's gonna retire, he ain't gonna be able to retire. Because his Social Security might be gone, or he might not be able to get, health insurance from the government, you know, through Medicare. And he's going to get screwed. And he probably won't even notice how bad he's getting screwed. Because there's going to be so many lies perpetrated on him.
Well, no, because he'll have the TV tuned to Fox and the radio tuned to the local, local right-wing blather station. And he will, whatever ill befalls him, there will be some right-winger there to tell him that it's because of those immigrants, those gays, those Negroes,
yes.
Those liberals, those women.
Yes. And it will never stop. And they'll just keep blaming the people who didn't do that to them. So what will happen if...
Right, and the capitalists will laugh all, and the capitalists will laugh all the way to the bank.
Yes. No, all the way to their yachts. It's like that there was something on one of your page. You know, why should I why should I bother about you people? I got to park my boat in my boat. And then somebody was parking a boat and a yacht. You know, and it's just like, they don't really give a shit. They're really, if you go to Europe's one of those countries where rich people say, why do I want to be a rich person in a poor country? In this country, they say, the rich people say, you know, I'm not rich until I see a lot of poor people. You know, it's really the opposite.
Yeah.
They don't care about us. And, I mean, you might want to put it on, not put it out there, but what I really think we got to do is what Europe did a long time ago. Start killing the bastards.
Well, see, we can't do that, though, because...
Oh, yeah, but they're doing it to us.
Well, they are, and they all, and wealth all, and wealth ever has. But there is a long... The history of the world is full of examples of poor people saying enough and deciding to take out the rich, and it winds up with a lot of dead poor people. Look, for instance, at the uprising of the Jacqueries in 14th century France. They did that two or three times, and the guys with the money on the horses just came in and slaughtered until nobody wanted to do it anymore. And then people say, yeah, but what about 1793 and the French Revolution? Yeah, and how did that work out? Well, you wind up with a monarchy back. You wind up with an emperor. How about October 1917 in Russia? By God, they showed those Romanovs something, didn't they? Well, yeah, they did. And they replaced one set of assholes with a different set of assholes.
But now we have total information control. And total everything, where they can see everything that everybody does on their laptops, anything. And they know everything that's going on.
Although you might be interested to know that a U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled today that the NSA spying program is illegal. The bulk collection of phone records, the government had gone in and argued it was legal under a provision, the business records provision of the Patriot Act, and the U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals said, uh-uh. So that'll be an interesting little thing to get heard by the Supreme Court.
What makes you think that the Koch brothers don't have their own computer programs and, you know, centers?
Well, they may, but they don't have their own internet.
Yeah, but they could tap into it.
And?
Very easy. But what's to say that they can't see what we're saying? And
well, I would personally love it if Chuck and Dave were listening to this program.
But they don't care about the program. They care about what people are doing, and they react upon that. And they have their little, and it's not even them. They just pay people to do their bidding for them.
Murdering murderers doesn't make, you know, two wrongs don't make a right, but two rights did make an airplane.
No, you're right, but one wrong does make something a little bit right, maybe. Maybe it's some sniper.
No, please, no. Next thing you know, I'll be getting a visit from the humorless people in black suits and white shirts and skinny black ties.
That's what I'm saying, too.
Yeah. Hey, I got to get out of here anyway, Carl, because we're right up against it, but thanks very kindly. Glad you finally got through.
Bye.
Bye now. Carl calling from Western Massachusetts. It is time to get out of here in a big way. Thank you, Randy, for jumping in this evening. We have fallen $150 short in fundraising this evening. Anybody wanting to help Randy is encouraged to do so. Maybe we'll be able to make it up on Friday on the front porch. Thanks to everybody who makes the program go. Thanks to all of you who sustain the program for all these many years. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Thanks to the hardest working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net, and ACAC.org. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Good night, y'all.